Good evening, everyone. You've tuned in to Paradigm Shifters. And who are Paradigm Shifters? People who are making a difference in the collective at this time on our planet. But when I say people who are making a difference, it isn't always people as we know them. Very often it's consciousness beings, and that's the privilege we have tonight, is to have the presence of Kathleen Kingdon, who is a person, channeling Dwal Kool, who's very much consciousness being. So we're doing a multidimensional discussion of the Enneagram and your soul and my soul. So welcome to the show, Kathleen.
Well, thank you, Veronica. It's great to be with you again.
It's wonderful to be with you, and I'm going to be, I'm actually very excited about exploring the Enneagram through Dwal Kool. I think this will be quite an interesting experience. Have you studied with him on this subject?
Actually, I studied with Helen Palmer, who's probably one of the foremost teachers. It was Master Dwal Kool who got me interested in it in the first place, but I've been using it since way back in the years when I was a psychotherapist, and found it as a terrific tool for personal development. And one of the wonderful things about it is, if you're sitting with a group of people and somebody's issues come up, if you talk about it in terms of the Enneagram, suddenly people can see that even their own issues may not be personal, that there is a whole field of people who probably experience similarly. Now, it doesn't mean their reactions, of course, are always similar, but nonetheless, the motivation that drives the type is quite similar and can be recognized, I think, by most people, given they have some, precociousness with energy.
Mm-hmm. Actually, it's a description of the orientation of the soul and its type of learning, isn't it? Was that what you would say, or how would you explain it?
When I'm working with psychotherapy, we don't generally talk in those terms. However, I think some have said that. There have been, I definitely think that the patterns that each being works with in a given life does have something to do with their soul's lesson or their soul's decision about what they maybe should be or are working on in a given life. And so clearly it's all connected. Mostly, at least I have pretty much seen that the Enneagram is more connected with the personality level than the soul level. So it's going to be very interesting to see what Master has to say about it. So we're probably both going to get an education today.
Yes, because I want to refer quickly before we get into talking to Master. Shall I call him that as well?
Well, you can if you want to. That's what I call him. I've called him that for years, and most of the students that work with him closely also call him that.
Well, the book that we talked about the last time we met, which is called The Matter of Mind and the Labyrinth of Our Minds. Anyway, I just love that, and I finally finished it at least the first time, and I will be rereading it. But when he talks about everything is projection, all of us are projecting all the time. And, and then, of course, he gives exercises or ways of centering ourselves away from projection. But I was thinking about the Enneagram going, well, does that describe the style of our projection? How does that work?
I would say it. One of the things that we might say about it is that, of course, the projections arise from the passion or the psychological complex that drives the personality. And so certainly they're very connected. For example, people who are fall under the Enneagram type 1 tend to have, and it's not just a mental state, it's completely a physical, emotional, and mental complex, because these people are sometimes believed by others to be critical. What others may not know is that they're very critical of themselves as well. But this is the person, or it's probably not only ones that do this, but it's a simple example. The person who walks into a room and sees that a picture is crooked and just can't help but put it straight is often a one. Now, other types do this too, but for the one, it's not just looking at the picture. There is an actually a gut experience, a felt sense of something is wrong. And for the one, they can't live with it until it's straightened out. Others, it might give a nicer sense of symmetry, or, they make up whatever story they do. So many people might have the same response. But to the one, there's a gut feeling about something not being right. And so this type tends to have a lot of energy with themselves about right and wrong, not necessarily in a cosmic sense, but for themselves. Mm-hmm. And the higher they develop, and the higher functioning the one is, then the more they're able to calm the internal demons. And I've heard it said by I've studied with a number of Enneagram specialists over the years, and I heard one of them say that this man is a Christian, Dr. Rohr, is a Christian Enneagram teacher, but he says that he sees many of his alcoholic clients are ones because they just can't stand the imperfection of the world. And of course, we all have moments where we can't stand the imperfection that's around us. But for ones, it's not just a recognition that something out there is wrong. It's an internal feeling. And the same might be said if we went around, the glyph and talked about all of the types. There is an internal sense that drives that personality style, and of course it does come from whatever the lessons a person is trying to learn in a given life are, and how their soul has manifested this psyche to approach life. So I find it a very, very interesting topic.
And you use that when you're working with people. You don't do work with people, individuals anymore, do you?
I'm no longer in practice. No, mm-hmm. Once in a while I will take a client who's referred now and then, but I don't do it very often. So.
Well, I'm eager to speak with Dwal Kool about the relationship between the Enneagram and the soul. I think that's quite an interesting question from my perspective.
All right. Well, if you'll just hold tight for a fraction of a second or two here, I'll get him.
Thank you.
Well, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. And how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm very happy to be speaking with you, so I'm particularly well right now. Thank you.
Not only are you particularly well, but my goodness, since we talked last, you've added probably a good half an inch to your auric field all over, and that's kind of a rare thing. I hope you don't mind my mentioning that on the radio, so congratulations.
I feel honored. Thank you so much.
Well, it's lovely to see your brilliance factor and to see that it's increased some, so that should give you some feedback that your spiritual practices are working and that you're actually growing, and even at a time when things are very chaotic,
here you are,
growing and glowing. So congratulations.
Thank you so much. What an honor to hear that. Here on Global Radio.
Here on Global Radio.
Well, I guess we're going to talk about the Enneagram and all that it refers to. And I have loved your book so much and really am not obsessed but fascinated by thinking of everything being projection and so on. So then I started to wonder about the Enneagram and its relationship to our soul's journey. And what is the nature of, for example, projection? Like, for example, do ones project a certain way and fours project a certain way? You know, what is the nature between the projections, the soul, and I don't know.
Well, actually, it's a very good question. There certainly is a similarity in the motivation for the projections, although it may not come out identically the same, let's say, with every four. But if you look at the four personality style, the basis for its arising has been a sense of something missing. And indeed, while this is the gut or internal feeling that the four individual can't avoid or can't get away from, for the rest of us, it may look however it looks. And indeed, the thing that gives each type the most pain is the very thing that type came to teach. So we could say that what the soul of the four is doing is trying to teach all those who are, let's say, in the collective experiential environment of the four that there's something missing. Often, people go through their lives and they don't really recognize there's anything missing, when perhaps what's really missing is a spiritual practice or a way of looking at the world that's big enough to incorporate not only the events of life, but basically how to fit oneself into it. And so the four, who often is seen as one who suffers a great deal because often the four wears their suffering on their sleeve, and you know, it's pretty hard not to if you happen to have the four style personality. But so while the four keeps feeling that something is missing, and let me tell you a little bit about how it plays out. For instance, the passion quality is envy for the four, and yet it isn't the kind of garden variety envy that most people think about. For example, if I am a four and I look at your relationship and for whatever set of reasons, I project that you have a great relationship, then I become envious of that. Now, I'm not envious that you have the great relationship. I'm envious that you have the great relationship. So you see, this kind of envy, I would not try to disrupt it or take it away from you or anything like that. It's just that I envy the fact that somebody can have it. And so, you know, the garden variety envy really comes down much more to a personal level, where if I'm envious of something you have and it's garden variety envy, I just want it, and so I don't mind taking it from you. But that's not actually the way it is for the four. And here I'm speaking of a spiritually evolved four. We can recognize that the unevolved might do it another way. But a spiritually evolved four is always comparing inwardly to what I have and what is missing. And sometimes this is difficult for those who love fours to be very close to them, simply because they feel the pain that this one feels. And yet, were it not for the quality and the quantity of pain that the four feels, the lesson to others that his or her soul is trying to bring forth, you know, usually what's missing is the spiritual link, you see. Mm-hmm. There are all kinds of ways of dealing with things psychologically, of course, but if one really wants healing, and this is true with childhood patterns, this is true with certainly true with past life patterns, but if one wants true healing from any kind of a psychological complex or any kind, complexes are difficult, but we'll just take, let's say a person is gravely wounded in the area of relationships. If one truly wants healing, they're going to have to go to the spiritual perspective, because you see, you'll never get healed by looking at who did what and who was to blame and who got it right and so on and so forth. You have to play it into a bigger context where it says, what does my pain tell me about humanity and its relationship to the divine? And so we take what is experienced in the smaller picture and look toward the vaster, bigger picture, and it's in that bigger picture that we come, if we're going to come to a healed state, it must be in a spiritual container, you see?
Mm-hmm.
So yes, the four personality projects in a certain way, mm-hmm. and what the soul is doing is, excuse me, through any projection, see, the soul, or you can't exactly say that the soul makes the projection, but certainly the soul allows for the personality to project in order for that individual to see his or her own short-sightedness. Now, I realize that's a lot of words, and it's fairly complicated. The Enneagram is a very sophisticated system, and I love what it offers spiritually. In fact, I don't think people can really get the full measure of the power of the Enneagram unless they move it into a spiritual.
So its purpose is actually to give us sort of access to our evolution, to being out of karma. Is it useful for that?
I think it's helpful for that, yes. Of course, first of all, you have to realize that the personality is projecting the thoughts and feelings of the type before you can ever transcend them. You know, if one is not aware that they're doing, let's say, a four projection, or they're doing a one projection, which is, that's just not right. You see, in four and one are share a lot of energy, because there's a movement between point four and point one on the Enneagram.
Mm.
But to make matters even more complicated, there are not just nine types, because every single type has three subtypes.
a
survival type, a social type, and a sexual type. And so there are actually 27 types. And so while we can say that the whole process of creation is always somehow invested in patterns, whether you look at the zodiac, you have 12 energy patterns. And to some people, there's great meaning in each of them. To other people, there isn't that much meaning because they're not familiar with the symbology and so on, or maybe not familiar with these energies. But to one who knows the energies, tremendous spiritual progress can come forth as a result of working with the zodiac or with astrology. Well, the Enneagram is somewhat like that. If a person approaches it just for the information, I don't think there's any way that the information will really give the kind of transformation that the Enneagram is capable of offering.
Well, it's sort of interesting you were talking about the one, or Kathleen, was of how it has a gut response to something being out of whack. So that just sort of reminds me that it's the gut, it's the actual feeling that the person has that gives the clue as to where they want healing or where they want to grow. Is that right?
That's always the case. However, that feeling will not always give you the type. For example, if you see a projection, we'll use a 2 and a 9.
Okay.
The 2 type clearly wants approval, but so does the 3 type, and so does the 9 type. Actually, certain 6s, the survival 6 looks very much like a 2, and certainly the social 9 looks very much like a 2. And so there are so many profound levels of energy in here that to sort them all out requires more than just a heady understanding. And this is one of those areas where understanding or mental concepts will just scratch the surface. Mm-hmm. There has to be a much broader understanding of how these energies flow. There is if you take the shape of the glyph, you can see that certain points are connected. And if you take the 3, 6, and 9, which is the triangle upon which the other star hangs, then you see that the 3, 6, and 9 is like a fulcrum on which the entire glyph hangs. And
so the glyph actually looks like a circle. For those who haven't seen it, it looks like a circle with triangles on it, which are placed equally apart, so that there's...
Well, not exactly. It's called the nine-pointed star.
Okay.
And so there are 6 angles. I suppose you could say they look like triangles, but they look like different types of triangles, don't they? The equilateral triangle is the glyph, or the fulcrum point, the 3, 6, and 9 point that upon which everything hangs.
Okay.
And you see, what's interesting about the 3, 6, and 9 is that they don't look like the group in which they are in. For instance, the 3 is in the middle of the heart triad, and yet, which is the 2, 3, and 4, and yet 3s often look more like they're in the gut triad or the work triad, which is 8, 9, and 1. The 9, who is in the gut triad, often looks more like he or she is in the head triad, because the 9 often tend to be very bright and very, very articulate and so on. Not all, but many. And then you have the 6, the third wing of that, which is sitting right in the middle of the head triad, and often they can appear to be in the heart triad. So the 6 is a fear-based type, you see, and so that seems like it's part of the heart, because it's clearly a feeling. So you begin to see that, you know, at the highest level, you could say that the soul could perhaps be represented in all 9 types. And so as it allows its extensions to take this life and that life and another life and so on, they then take on these different focal points on the Enneagram so that the soul can be whole. Mm-hmm. And in other words, we could say that the soul will have experienced. And as you know, souls, even through a given extension, may have thousands or even millions of lifetimes. Not all of those are very long, but nonetheless, it's all possible. And as this happens, basically the soul is just trying to have a broad experience of what it is to be physical. The soul is not a physical being. Mm-hmm. It's not even a manifest being. You see, it's a non-manifest being that hangs somewhere between the physically manifest being of the self and the non-physically but certainly manifest level of the monad. And I guess we're getting into very broad terminology here, but the soul is sort of the intermediary part that you could say draws the energy of the God level to the single individuated self level. And so the soul kind of connects those two. And while the soul has a lot of lessons to learn through its physical extensions, it's also had a whole lot of learning before it was ever allowed to precipitate into physical reality and even have extensions. So we could say that perhaps the dance of the Enneagram, which, and this is the direction of the energies, for instance, the one, you know, moves to the 4, which moves to the 7, which moves to the 5, which moves to the 8, which moves to the 2, and so on. You have this kind of dance of energy moving around. And if we could say that that is somewhat like the soul's journey as it encounters not just what's going on through the lives of its extension, but as it experiences physical reality as a whole. And of course, this means it would be also experiencing all the hundreds of thousands of galaxies that are in this universe and even some of the other universes that cannot be observed from planet Earth.
Wow. Well, let me just move back for a minute and pick. I'm going to pick something really easy just so that we can place that kind of logistical thought in the middle of all this, because this is a lot, but I need to, bring, for example, we start off with being a 2, for example, and the 2 moves to an 8, is that right?
It can move to 8, it can also move to 4. Usually it's seen that when it's in a point of disintegration, it moves to 8. When it's in a point of superintegration, or it's called its high side, it moves to 4.
So the process of going to all those numbers is the process of improvement or integration of lessons, or...
Well, mostly the 2, you see, okay, the 2 is also influenced by its 1 wing and its 3 wing.
Okay.
And so it will tend to also have some habits or projections that fall along or maybe look like a 1 or a 3. But since the 2 is not a 1 or a 3, the energy behind it will be different. Now, when, let's say, a 2 who is that this type is a very is probably the core of the heart type, and it feels a great deal of love and compassion for nearly everyone, particularly those to whom they are close. But let's say a 2 mother or a 2 father is in a situation where they perceive some danger could come to one of their children. That 2 can very rapidly become an 8, and if you know anything about 8, the energy is really big, it's excessive, it's has a lot of vibrato, and that vibrato is often there to scare off would-be assailants. But it moves into this. Now, does the 2 become an 8? No. But because the lines on the glyph are connected, it will move toward 8 when something needs to be happened. Another thing that the 2 does that is kind of an 8-like quality, not all the time would the 2 do this, but in certain situations, and the 8 is an individual that is into excess, and I mean the saying is too much, too long, too loud, the life of the party, and so on. They tend to be very exciting people to be around, and so clearly, if there is some if a 2 is threatened, he or she might move into 8 to take this stance of this big energy. When you walk into the room, if there's an 8 in the room, you always know it. You don't always notice a 2 in the room. I mean, you might notice the person, but you don't necessarily notice the energy. Mm-hmm. So these are points of movement along the glyph that say something about the soul's dance.
So it's like a toolkit in a way, isn't it?
Yes, in a way it is.
Mm-hmm. And so for a person who doesn't know, I mean, it's really helpful to know what your Enneagram is, isn't it?
I think so, yes.
How do you find out what your own is outside of being told?
Well, you have to be very careful about being told, because sometimes when people are telling, they don't necessarily, they might be reading the actions rather than reading the energy.
Mm.
For example, as I said, we'll go back to straightening the picture on the wall. A six type, which is basically a fear type, and of course there's really two types, two six types. There's the phobic six and the counterphobic six, and each of those have three subtypes. But the six might move the picture to straighten, but they would do this because it feels safer when that picture is straight than it does when it's not. I mean, you know, somebody could sit under it, the thing could fall off the wall, and so on. I mean, it's a whole different construct, even though the activity might be the same. So if someone who is familiar with the Enneagram sees you adjusting the picture on the wall, and they assume, oh, all ones do this, and by the way, all ones don't, but all of them will feel something at the crooked picture, then you see they could be leaving out a whole lot of things. Number one, that somebody could feel unsafe around a picture that was hanging precariously. Or if it was a three, might also move the picture, but it might be because everything has to look perfect for the three. It's not the same kind of perfection, but the three won't be accepted if they haven't done things neatly and in a way that is acceptable to the rest of the world, because the three is very much into his or her image. And so for a three to have a crooked picture on their wall doesn't say very much about their image. So so you have to be a little bit careful about people telling you. I suggest the best way to find one's type is if you can find an Enneagram teacher who does panels. And you come in one night and they have all ones on the panel, and hopefully this is a good interviewer who interviews these people. How do you feel about this? By the end of an hour or so of just listening to all of these ones, they won't look alike. They won't necessarily even have the same choices in certain situations. But you will begin to feel the one energy because they're sort of on display up there. And as they begin to talk about both the high sides and the low sides of their own type, as they begin to talk about the things that allow them to be a great spiritual being as well as the things that trip them up a bit, then this energy of the one permeates the room. And it's very interesting. For many people, the one energy is not comfortable in their bodies. And this tells you something. There's nearly always a knot in the pit of the stomach of the one, you see, there are just so many things that aren't right.
About themselves, probably.
Oh, everything, about everything. Now, the more evolved they are, the more they start looking inwardly and really trying to dissolve this fixation. It is kind of a fixation, or you could say a constant projection. And then little projections will come out of that from moment to moment that say something about what's going on in the mind right now. So in terms of spiritual development, I think the Enneagram is very helpful because if you look at what the Enneagram does, if you just look at the spiritual traditions on the planet, you will recognize that some are head-based. For instance, Buddhism is very heady. Even the great compassion teachings of the Mahayana seem very heady for when you compare it to a lot of other religions. Christianity has certain sects that are very head-based, right and wrong, so on and so forth, and they do this kind of apologia for everything, although Christianity would normally be seen much more as a heart-based spiritual practice. So would, let's say, Sufism. But if we take something like, put Hinduism in that as well, because it's a very heart-based spiritual journey. Now, the gut base tend to be more like Tai Chi, the martial arts, Native American approaches, where the energy is really in the belly. And so when a person is looking for a spiritual path, some people are very attracted to Native American practices. Mm-hmm. Others are not. And this isn't good or bad. It's just telling you that when they come to their experience of it, if someone who's had, let's say, a lot of positive experience from past lives through Native American spirituality, he or she will be drawn right in and will love it. Someone else who has maybe never encountered that, let's say they've had life after life after life where they're Buddhist, they're so geared at trying to get the mind focused in such a way, that, I mean, they can allow it in, certainly, And yet, you know, if we also look at Asian traditions, certainly all of the martial arts are gut-based because they try to get you out of your head, don't they? Mm-hmm. You have to be in the moment completely, not reacting to everything, just allowing earth energy to move through you to create your responses. And if a person is in their head, they lose if they're trying to learn, do martial arts fighting. If they're in their heart, they lose because they're either feeling sorry or they're fascinated with the person they're sparring with or something, and that's a recipe for disaster. Thus, they have to get in their gut, and when that gut is open and clean, you could say there are three centers of perception. This is how the Enneagram would say the gut, which is the pivotal point on the Enneagram glyph, is the 9 point. The heart, again, the pivotal point is the 3. And the head, the pivotal point is 6. And it's interesting that these 3 points can really look like they belong elsewhere. Mm-hmm. But anyway, when you see the whole picture and you recognize how infinite is the possibility for virtually any kind of reaction to come forth in any moment, it's all a very, very big picture. And this is why.
Before we go past this, what are the 3 of the head, 3 of the heart, 3 of the gut?
The gut is the 8, the 9, and the 1.
Okay.
The heart is the 2, the 3, and the 4. Okay. And the head is the 5, the 6, and the 7.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry to interrupt you, but I just wanted to get that clear.
That's all right. I tend to, you know, hang out in the big picture, and I sometimes forget to bring it down to a really concrete place, because that's where people learn, you see?
And we want to get with you to the big picture, because I'm very aware, especially from talking to you before and reading the book, on we can move out of the whole karmic thing. And I just think there's a really wonderful pathway through that, isn't there?
Yes. And I will tell you, it's not simple.
Oh darn.
Yes, it is an oh darn. Many people, and I think this is particularly true in the West, Veronica, there are so many people that think if they just have the knowledge, that's all it takes. And in truth, it's much bigger than that. Because, you know, you probably have met people who have read thousands of books and maybe even have a really good grasp of what was in all that material.
Mm-hmm.
But their lives may not be any less pain-ridden than those of other people. And so the ultimate test, of course, is really just sitting there with your own ego personality and learning how to see through it. And for this particular activity, I don't know of a better tool right now that's in the hands of people in the West than the Enneagram. But it does require a fair amount of study, and it requires a whole lot of don't know. So I had one client once, and he came to me, and he wanted to talk about his Enneagram type, and so I had sent him out to read a bunch of books, and I came back, and I said, well, what do you think you are? And he says, well, I have this, some from this type, and have some from this type, and have some from this type, and so on. And I told him his type number, and I thought he was going to be sick right there in the little room. And he came back later and says, I've thought this over seriously. He said, you're absolutely right. But he says, I think what a person should do is read diligently all of the types, and the one that they just can't stand is probably who they are. And there's some truth in that, you see. So it's very interesting.
And that's because we're always fighting with that inner part of ourselves. We're trying to conquer certain things, aren't we?
Yes, and I often think that people aren't really as aware as they might think they are of what's going on inwardly and the kind of energy that they're emitting in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, someone might be yelling at another person, and the second person says, well, why are you so angry? And the first person says, I'm not angry. I'm really hurt.
Ah.
And yet the energy that the person is giving off pretty clearly wasn't easily read as hurt by the other.
Mm-hmm.
And so many times I think people don't let themselves know what kind of energy they're putting off, because now if you happen to be doing anger as a 1, then this anger isn't the kind of anger that blows up at everybody. It's really an undercurrent energy. It's more the energy of resentment. And the 1 resents the fact that God didn't get it right. You know, there are just too many imperfect things here. Sometimes parents leave their children. Sometimes people don't pay their taxes and create a burden for their relatives. But there are so many reasons. Now, you see, the one's lessons are very important because it's trying to teach humanity that things are not just okay the way they are. And so the lesson at the bigger level is very important. Now, how it gets played out is another thing. But you see, because the one has a kind of perfection fixation, he or she cannot allow himself or herself to be seen by themselves as angry, because angry is not perfect. So the anger then kind of devolves down into a resentment.
Or a seething
kind
of thing.
Sometimes you can feel the resentment energy, but often I find that when ones are really angry, they don't know they're angry. And this is somewhat true for every type. It's perhaps easiest to see. Now, if you want to see anger raging, you'll see the other side of the gut triad, which is the eight. And say they can be like volcanoes. And it can be very hot and very pointed and very excruciating to be on the other end of. But for them, you see, this is categorically different than the one. They express it and it's over. 10 minutes later, you say, I have to ask you what you meant when you were saying that. And the person might just as well say, oh, I didn't mean that. I was just angry. And because there is this rush of huge energy that has to go somewhere.
I know some people like that.
Yes, they usually know they're angry, whereas the one doesn't. Mm-hmm. Now, the nine also, the nine's anger, because you could say that the gut triad is also the anger triad, you see? And the anger for the nine gets played out in stubbornness. Often the nine has no idea that he or she is angry. In fact, sometimes it's harder to get the nine to see that they're angry than it is everyone else. But when they're angry, they dig the heels in. They won't call you back. They ignore you. It's a total avoidant path. And this doesn't look like anger. But the energy, you see, that's going on inside the gut of that person is truly anger. But they do some very interesting ways of masking it so they won't have to see it. You see? And so it's a very, very interesting thing.
So tell me, what's the nine's motivation for not wanting to see it themselves?
Well, I don't think anybody at the personality level really wants to see their flaws, do you?
No.
Now, you get a little higher than that, and yes, the more evolved they are, the more they want to see where they might be hurting other people or where they might be causing a stumbling block or something like that. But when one is just beginning their path, often they're quite blind. That, for instance, I can remember, I don't think she'll mind my saying this, but when Kathleen was doing psychotherapy, I remember she... one of the things that always surprised her was that when alcoholics would come in and talk about what was going on, especially when they're trying to heal, one of the biggest problems that she had was to try to get them to see that their actions had any effect on anybody else at all. And this is true for alcoholics all the way around the Enneagram. It's not one type. They would say, well, you know, it's my problem. But they don't see how it disrupts the family. They really don't see it until they grow and get their, let's say, their personal boundary walls a little bit bigger so that it includes other people as well. So it's just very interesting how not only the projections come forth, but how there are similarities not only to the type of energy that one puts out, but there are also similarities in terms of how a given energy is disguised. So if you move to the heart triad, and here the energy is love, but it's done quite differently. To the two, they're saying, love me, love me, I will love you so much you can't help but love me. And to the four now, we'll skip the three and come back. To the four, the message comes out, love me, love me. I'm so terrible. Nobody can love me. Can you love me? But it's very hard to be on the other end because you're wrong if you love and you're wrong if you don't love. You see? It's very tricky. It requires some real subtlety to see through this. The three, which is in the middle of these other two points, is the one whose fixation or typology or projection says, I'll look so good, you can't help but love me. I'll perform so well, you can't help but love me. And while it looks, the three is the classic person. All threes look good in the society, partly because in the United States, it's pretty much a three culture.
Mm.
It's all about image. It's what you have. It's how you look. It's how you, all of that. Well, you know, there are people who could use a little more attention to image and be a little less sloppy about how they get up in the morning and treat others and so on. But to the three is the chameleon. Who would know this is a heart energy? Trying to be approved of and fit in by, I can look just like you. And so if I'm coming to a party at your house and your friends are all cowboys, doesn't matter if I'm a Wall Street banker, if I'm a three, I will have a hat and boots.
Right.
Because I can fit in, I can blend, and you will love me.
How do these loving beings get angry?
The three?
Mm-hmm. The three, four, and two.
Well, it's very interesting. Sometimes in anger, as we mentioned earlier, the two goes to eight and becomes volcanic.
Mm.
The four with anger can look pretty one-like. It can be very righteous. You did this, and you did this, and you did this, you know. I always tell my students that their memory gets very sharp, and they tell me they don't have memory. So, just get angry, and your memory will get very sharp. So it looks very accusing. And, of course, here we have, what the four really wants is to be special.
Ah.
And that is, again, a driving thing. In other words, fours tend to be very warm people. And most people do like them until they get angry at them or something like that. But most people are drawn in by this warmth because it's genuine. And then all of a sudden the four sees what's missing. You didn't love them the way they wanted to be loved in that moment. And something about their ego is shattered. And so the reaction to that can be very biting, very personal, very stinging. It's kind of like... Well, it's a little bit akin to Scorpio energy, although any type, of course, can be Scorpio, where that's the stinger comes up, and there's a little bit of treachery, and so on. And so anger for the four is usually something that he or she will justify. Their anger is quite justified, and the justification process often looks like one. To the one, it would be personal, but to the four, it would be very personal. Hmm. And so it's a different kind of, the energy of anger from a four often has a kind of slicing quality to it, like a very sharp knife or machete or something like this. And so that's a little bit different. The three is anger avoidant. So the three will do anything, just about, both the three and the nine. Well, the six does this too. All are anger avoidant, but for different reasons. For the nine, it's not comfortable. For the three, it's a threat of not being loved. And for the six, it's fearful. Something bad could happen as a result of this anger. Mm-hmm. So basically, now when a six gets angry, it can be very interesting. Often it is also very personal and can be very sharply pointed. But you see, depending on whether the six is in their counterphobic stage or their phobic stage, that fear looks quite different. Or excuse me, the anger looks quite different. If they're in their phobic stage, they're probably afraid of their own anger.
Hmm.
They might be afraid that they'll hurt somebody else, but more than likely they're afraid that if they get angry, somebody else will hurt them. To the counterphobic six, on the other hand, it's just the opposite. They look like an eight. They can come in and blast and sort of blast everybody out of the room. Hmm. And who would think that this is coming from a fear perspective? But, of course, it is. In other words, something isn't safe. And so
it's defensive.
It's like the animal in nature, you know, who puffs up mm-hmm. to be safe, to scare off the enemies, you see?
Mm-hmm. Clever. What about the five?
Oh, the five. Well, the five has the energy of the five is a kind of hoarding energy. And it's basically a hoarding of, well, it's hoarding energy more than anything else. And yet, if you kind of look at many fives, they will have been, Kathleen's a five. And years ago, before anybody started recycling, she had all these plastic jugs she didn't know what to do with because she was buying water from them, and nobody was taking them back, and she thought they ought to be recycled, but where she was living didn't have a recycling program. And one day she looked in there and thought, boy, if anybody looked at this, they would think I'm hoarding 1 gallon plastic jugs. Now, she didn't care at all for the jugs, but the type was there, you see, putting them all neatly away, stacking them up, until she found a place that would take them and recycle them. And so it plays out somewhat different person to person, but often the five is received or seen as, by others as withholding energy, withholding emotion, withholding affection sometimes. Now, the higher evolved they are, of course, they begin to recognize that, well, in this case, you know, maybe I should say a little bit more. Fives often don't have very much to say, or they'll ask them how they are, and they'll say, well, I'm fine. And to them, that's accurate and quite adequate. To other people, they're really wanting to know a little more, or they wouldn't have asked that question. So it may seem like the five is withholding information or energy or whatever. To the five, however, the five if you see people who are true minimalists, they're often fives. The five is the hermit. The five is the yogi that goes into the cave and stays there for just to work on the mind, you see. But the five is a head type. Mm-hmm. And so with all the head types, five, six, and seven, you can kind of tell them because their energy, they have the energy of kind of figuring things out. Whereas the gut type, just the gut triad, let's say, eight, nine, and one, just goes on their instinct. They know, and they will know often. Mm-hmm. If they're clear, what they need to do in every situation. They can't explain it. It's not a thought-out thing. It's a gut instinct. Mm-hmm. Whereas the heart people will be more driven by their feelings. Mm-hmm. The head type more tries to figure out what's appropriate, what's needed, what's the right answer, and so on. So
will he get angry? Will the five type get angry?
Oh, yes, and sometimes, but see, five is also connected to seven and eight. So there are fives who, when they get angry, they don't feel much like an eight, but they can puff up and really release anger. And then, of course, they have to go hide because it's so unlike their nature to be big and loud and so on. But often anger on the five is turned inward. Not always. And if we take a gender perspective, I would say more often this happens for women fives, if they turn their anger inward and get depressed. And it's more likely that a male five will find a way to, and might very well use a lot of accusations in his anger. But five is kind of anger avoidant as well, as is the seven. Hmm. Now, the seven is the eternal optimist. And if you see someone, I mean, there are those who are very high-functioning sevens like Brian Tracy. But if you listen to his teachings, you'll hear everything is about feeling good, feeling good, feeling good. You find the one thing, and then you do it with your best effort and so on and so forth. But then you're always saying, I like myself. I like myself. Now, to a seven, this is very natural. To other people, it's not that natural. You see, and sevens are sometimes seen as people that don't want to get into anything very heavy. And I was teaching a class once, and one woman, lovely woman, raised her hand. She was a seven, and she says, well, what's so great about depression? And that is the way the seven sees it. They wouldn't do it if it weren't great. And so they kind of steer, but they're really into fun. They have a lot of fun. They want to bring fun to others. They have a great fascination with other people. Until they know them, and then they're kind of boring, you see. But anyway...
Cast then, of thousands, right?
Yeah, sevens are very anger-avoidant as well. So basically, it's pretty interesting look here, isn't it? And we've only taken anger. How about that?
I know. It's actually wonderful to see the whole broad spectrum. So it seems like it's very valuable to have figured out at least some of what the people around you are expressing or what a lot of people are expressing, because you wouldn't take it as personally, would you?
Well, it is helpful if you can say, well, let's see, what's the motivation? And this is something you often can't really intuit all that clearly, because if you happen to be the recipient of somebody else's, let's say, unclear projection, it might not occur to you to ask the person, well, now, why are you saying that? You know, I mean, you could...
Hurling epithets.
Well, yes, I remember I was trying to coax a mother once, and she said her little girl was given to crying fits. And I said, well, you need to ask her. You've got to give her language for her emotions. Is she angry? Is she sad? Is she frustrated? Is she what? You can't just assume you know what's going on because she cries. And so, in a way, this is one of the skills that's important in working with one's own type. And I think this is the real value in the lesson, is for the person to keep asking him or herself, why am I doing this? And it's not okay to say, I'm doing this because so-and-so did something else first. That's the cop-out. One is only allowed to say, I'm doing this because, am I angry? Am I sad? Am I? And we have to get away from blame altogether. And say, okay, I'm angry. So what's underneath that anger? Is it a fear that I'm not safe? Is it the fact that I can't handle anymore this imperfect creation? Is it the fact that I just am not going to let somebody else tell me what to do? We've gone from 6 to 1 to 9 there, in case you didn't notice. But you have to look at what the motivation is. And I think sometimes it's very hard for people to admit, for instance, to a 6, it's very hard to admit they're fear-based.
Mm-hmm.
They spent their life trying to cover it up. And to them, it seems weak to say, I'm a fearful person,
mm-hmm.
You see. But in the same way, the one is going to try and cover up his or her resentment. It doesn't feel good to say, well, I'm a resentful person.
So what you're saying is that they might do that unconsciously, but if they begin to do it consciously, they've got access to changing.
Well, I think the whole idea of working with the Enneagram is to make these energies conscious. In fact, so much of what spiritual growth is all about is making conscious those things that have heretofore been unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
And does this help? Yes. Mm-hmm. Is it something that most people can kind of figure out on their own? I've not seen very many who have.
So you need the teacher. Tell me this. I'm really interested in this, and I keep asking it in different ways, I think. Do we maintain our personalities through our lifetime so that we are hauling along, for example, a 4 imprint or a 4 style for lifetimes?
That's a very good question. Actually, there isn't a given formula for that, but I can tell you there is sort of a type of a rule, and that is that, you know, as the soul is extending itself through these various personalities, the whole idea is to evolve each one of them to their highest potential. And let's say if you have 4 energy, the highest potential of that is to not let oneself dip in at a personal level and feel unspecial. Maybe the person will always feel a need for wanting to be special, but when he or she is awake enough to see that that's the need that's driving them, and then they can also see how it not only drives their personality, but maybe it's driving people away from them on the other side of the fence, then there's some useful knowledge there. And so if I, let's say...
I mean, just knowing it is going to melt some of it.
Well, I think it does at first. And then you come to the next level where most people want to get rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that requires a whole different energetic... I mean, maybe the goal isn't to get rid of it so much as it is to raise it to a higher level.
Mm-hmm.
You see, the 4 person has the ability, like none other, to make other people feel special.
Oh, I'm a 4.
Yes. It's partly why you're good at what you do, you see?
Oh. Well, I'm fascinated by that whole special thing, because obviously if I'm wanting to do radio and television, I must have some drive to be special. And in fact, I'm kind of aware that that comes up in me sometimes. Not that I want to just talk about me. I'm just saying that I do know
right.
The process, you know.
But I think also when we're looking at you've got a pretty evolved psyche. You're not just starting out at the 4. You're ready
that's
to
right.
graduate at the 4 level, you see?
Mm-hmm.
And that's, there's a huge difference between the highest functioning of a type and the lowest functioning of a type. And they almost don't even look like they're related.
But when you're working with a small child, like a two-year-old or three-year-old, you can actually use this and help them with it when they're very young, couldn't you?
Well, yes. However, I find that the typology, many people will say that the type is not solidified in childhood. I think it's pretty solidified by age 9. There will be indicators. Now, if you have an 8, that'll be obvious probably by 3 or 4. And yet, many children who are not destined to be 8s also throw tantrums. Mm-hmm. So the tantrum energy is kind of an 8 energy. But then they grow up and you find out, oh, they're not 8s after all. You see? So you have to be much more careful with children because they're sort of in flux. It isn't all set up so firmly yet. Certainly, they do not yet have access to it at those earlier ages.
And so we could lock them in, and that would be very bad, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
It would be dangerous.
And so I think the important thing with children, and I think this is true of children all the way up to 60 or 80, you know, is to, when you're really close to someone, is saying, I noticed you just did this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really curious. Can you tell me why you did that?
Mm-hmm.
And, sometimes you just kind of downplay it. You say, you know, I'm trying to understand you, and I think in a thousand lifetimes, I don't think I would have come up with that.
Mm-hmm.
Could you just let me in on the process? Well, what this does, see, it's not a critical thing at all. It's a curious thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the beauty of it is that if you can teach the other, whether it's a little child, a young child, an adolescent child or older, or yourself, to be curious about what is going on, then you have really helped that person.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can hold back your judgment, whether you see this trait is good or this trait is bad, if you can withhold that and just say, why?
Mm-hmm.
No good or bad here. You know, I mean, there's certainly traits that are useful, and it's probably not useful to have a child running around punching other children in the face.
No,
so that's not a
idea.
Useful thing, and you want to curtail that behavior.
Mm-hmm.
But the way you do it really is help the child understand why he or she might have an inclination to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And to really point out that, have you noticed that other children don't do that?
So having them ask about themselves and sort of get to understand, that's the big route to self-discovery.
Right, and I find that most people aren't very good at that until they're at least in their 30s. if you just think about adolescents, and we'll take the male adolescent, we'll take the female too, because when the hormonal component comes into play, they look quite different.
Mm-hmm.
The female tends to have more emotional cycles of weepiness, of feeling put upon, treated unfairly, this thing. And the young male adolescent tends to have more anger type issues. And so even at this age, they're not very good.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they understand the language. But with the hormonal complex and the drive of the personality and the repetitive projections of mind, they're not really able to penetrate all of that
mm-hmm.
and get deep understanding as to their own behavior. So probably it's going to be a parent or a teacher who's going to say, why did you do that?
And so, you know, unfortunately, we're out of time, but I'm thinking our next conversation, maybe we'll get into the value of aging or these age-related aspects of developing wisdom in people. It's a very exciting discussion too, isn't it?
Well, certainly, the scope of psychological and spiritual development in the human being is very, very broad, and it's why, you know, people are still in human form trying to figure it out. If this were easy, there are a lot of people living right now that have spent most of their life trying to figure out what goes on in their psyche. Maybe they haven't had adequate tools. Maybe they haven't had experiences that allow them to see anything bigger than what's, let's say, on the ego screen.
Mm-hmm.
But if it were easy, all of these would have straightened it all out by now. So I think the whole psycho-spiritual complex of the human being is incredibly interesting, and so I'm delighted that that you're interested in it as well. And who knows, maybe some of your listeners would even like to go a little more deeply into this, and we'll see. Certainly, I'm open for anything, because I just like to work with people who have a lot of questions and who are actively seeking more and more ways to understand what their life is all about, and in fact, who they really are, you see?
How wonderful. And you can be reached through www.vajraflame.org, right?
Yes.
And I'm so looking forward to our next in the series with Dwal Kool through Kathleen Kingdon. And I thank you so much for your time. I've learned a lot today. Thanks.
You're very welcome. I, too, have enjoyed it. And I thank you for your service. I think you're providing something that is of great benefit to a lot of people. And I only see that audience as growing, actually. So get ready for the next big movement, all right?
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
All right. Good night.
I'll give you Kathleen.
Thank you.
Well, hello, Veronica. It's Kathleen. I know we're out of time.
So was wonderful, Kathleen. I learned a lot. Did you?
Oh, I always learn when Master talks. It's amazing. But anyway, thank you so much. And
thank you. We will be in touch. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good night.